Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast. For today, I want to take up the recent elections that happened in the Midwest and to look not just at the horse race results, but maybe have a larger picture of what's happening in the sort of region. Because I think my colleague Chris Lehman, who's our guest this week, has a sort of interesting argument that we're seeing a partial progressive revival in the region. And this is really the sort of, these are the sort of battleground states where political power is decided in America, not just in presidential elections, but really in sort of, in terms of the Congress. These are kind of like bellwether states and very important. And there's a larger story here places that, had been once for a long time very Democratic and then started turning red. And now there's a partial pushback. It's not complete. It's not everywhere. But the tides do seem to be turning. And I think that is a very important story in American politics. So first of all, Chris, thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you, Gene. It's always a pleasure.
So I think for listeners, it might be good to get a sort of broader picture. Like what's the kind of story of these states? What are the states that we're talking about? And also what's the history there where there used to be, famously the blue wall, the sort of, the buttress of Democratic power and what happened?
Right. Well, as you noted, the big caveat here is we're talking about a very small sample size in the 2023 election cycle, where there was a race for to replace a Supreme Court justice seat in Wisconsin, which has been the site of a long-running reactionary statewide political push. And in Chicago, there was a really important mayoral race where a very sort of traditional Rahm Emanuel-like neoliberal candidate named Paul Vallis was sort of the anointed establishment candidate. And Brandon Johnson, who is the left reform candidate, won in an outcome that certainly shook the Chicago political establishment. And, the backstory here, as you say, is the upper Midwest, as recently as Obama's 2012 campaign, was regarded as the blue firewall. These were the kind of states that the Democratic Party was counting on to deliver in a nationwide election contest. And it worked in 2012. You may recall that I think it was when Ohio broke for Obama. That's when the election was called in his favor. Looking back, that's not that, talking 11 years ago. And if you look at the political history of the Midwest from that point on, it is this story of just unbelievable kind of right-wing success after right-wing success. Trump is largely credited with, mobilizing the fabled kind of disaffected white working class in the region. But in point of fact, you know, Scott Walker had been dismantling the public sector union movement in Wisconsin. It was sort of his ideological mission coming into office. All these states have also been heavily gerrymandered, which is an outcome of the disastrous 2010 off-year cycle that preceded Obama's reelection. And so, you know, what we've seen in, you know, these former kind of upper Midwestern blue wall states like Wisconsin and Iowa and Michigan has been a pronounced turn rightward. But what's happened, you know, and going back to 2022 in the midterms, Michigan ran the table. Michigan is now an all blue state. All three senior executive officials in the state are Democrats and women. And I think there is a couple of things are at play here. One is the intensity of the reactionary movement, as tends to be the case, bred a lot of sort of robust counter-organizing on the left. So, you know, by targeting the labor movement in Wisconsin, for example, Scott Walker radicalized the union movement, and they became very good at political organizing and very, you know, acting in their own self-interest, trying to get Democrats elected. And, you know, that because of the gerrymandering impact, you had kind of this mirage-like quality to Republican power in Wisconsin. For the last several cycles, Democrats have won pretty solid majorities in the popular vote, but because of the way the state is districted, Republicans continue to hold, you know, outsized majorities in the legislature. So when you get to a statewide race like this Supreme Court justice race, it's one of the occasions where the popular vote is really decisive. In addition, obviously, a huge issue that's also changed politics since 2022 has been the Dobbs ruling. And that was very much on the ballot in the Wisconsin race. You know, the two main issues in Wisconsin were the right to reproductive choice and the right to ballot access, the right to have your vote actually matter again. The other reason Wisconsin is important looms very large in 2024. Ali Alexander, the sort of MAGA activist, confessed this on Twitter, is, you know, if the Republicans are going to try to run, you know, another kind of January 6th, you know, voter fraud, you know, fake allegations of voter fraud to undo the result, the Wisconsin Supreme Court could be very decisive in flipping the results to the Republicans. Now, with a majority of liberals on the court, that's not likely to happen. So, you know, like all of, you know, and these are all results determined by convulsions in local politics that have been, you know, following the lead of the Trump movement on the right since 2016. I think the really important thing to flag in the case of Michigan is Michigan Republicans, following the example of the Glenn Youngkin race in 2021, went all in on the moral panic about critical race theory, about parental choice in the schools, and it blew up in their face. Tudor Dixon made it basically, she was the GOP gubernatorial nominee, and she made it basically her signature issue. She lost by 11 points to Christine Whitmer. So that is, or Gretchen Whitmer, sorry. That is a really significant result. And I think, you know, the GOP is in this position right now. You see it with Ron DeSantis's presidential run. They're going all in on these kind of culture war issues. And the framing culture war is also a bit misleading, but maybe we could get to that later. But the fact of the matter is, these are not really strong popular issues. And you yourself have written on how the anti-trans moral panic, which they're also investing heavily in, is not a tested winner in these kind of states. I think there is, you know, I'm not prone to any form of optimism or really faith in human nature, broadly speaking. But I do think there is a kind of inflection point where people see political actors just behaving meanly, you know, just aggressively targeting outgroups and making, you know, kind of outlandish claims about their nature that are really crude caricatures. And you know, people have, especially, I think, in the kind of suburban swing districts that the Republicans need in order to win a lot of these races, people have very regular contact with their public schools. They're one of the places where you most deeply sort of engage with government. And they don't regard them, you know, they're flawed. They deliver, you know, perhaps uneven results. But they know that they're not hotbeds of Maoist, you know, cultural indoctrination. They just know that because they're parents, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And also, I mean, like, I would add libraries to that, which is like...
Yeah, which is another target in Missouri. Right.
Part of, like, Republican, so-called, you know, we'll call it culture war. But I mean, like, they're really targeting libraries. And I got to say, like, you know, if you I just, like, you can look at public opinion polls, but you can also just like be a person in the world and be aware that, like, you know, people like libraries.
Right. And again, I think
like libraries, they like librarians. I mean, that's considered, like, you know, one of the, you know, most benign possible occupations that someone could have is to be a librarian. It's perhaps worth, like, you know, like, on a broader politics thing, like, maybe thinking about where the culture wars work and where they don't. Because I think, actually, in some ways, the this upper Midwest is an interesting test case. Because I do think that, you know, things like Dobbs, trans, the war on schools and libraries, they're especially unpopular there. They might be a little bit more, you know, it's more of a wash in the, obviously, the red states and in the South. But I think part of the issue is just the nature of the population, that there's a lot of, like, very, you know, secular white non-college people there. And these are the people that, like, went for Trump in 2016, and they partially went for him because, you know, he had the sort of, you know, claim that he'll, like, you know, break with the consensus, the Washington consensus on neoliberalism and NAFTA, and, you know, like, go after these trade agreements, which they knew hurt them, and that Hillary Clinton wouldn't. And also, you know, like, he seemed like a different sort of Republican. Like, he seemed like, you know, like a guy who, you know, probably doesn't care a lot about, you know, like, gay issues one way or the other. You know, very libertarian, you know, quite possibly has paid for abortions himself. Like, happy to, you know, hang out with, like, you know, play his libertinism in some ways, like, perhaps worked as an advantage for those kind of voters, in the sense that, oh, you know, like, this is, you know, he's not going to be, like, you know, trying to push the Bible down my throat, right? Like, he's a guy.
He barely knows how to hold a Bible, as we saw.
And in some ways, I mean, he was able to, like, the 2016 thing, Trump was really able to play on both sides, because he had his own, you know, sort of libertinism, and then he was had Mike Pence, you know, who's the complete opposite, you know, who's very clearly, like, you know, visibly homophobic, you know, uncomfortable even with, like, you know, women in the workplace, and so you know, you could read into the campaign whatever you wanted. The evangelicals read into him, I think, quite correct. They were the sounder judges of these things. They read that, you know, Trump would give them what they want.
I think actually Trump's hypocrisy was an asset. Like, you know, people have understood, you know, well beyond his political career, that he's a liar. You know, people watched The Apprentice for 10 years, right? And, you know, they knew he wasn't, his adherence to a lot of these issues was not the kind of rigid moral stance that the Mike Pences of the world had staked out. I think the other thing I wanted to flag when we were talking about the firewall too is The reason that there was a firewall at all was that Barack Obama bailed out the auto industry in 2009. Yeah. And that was a huge issue. It actually was a very strong contrast with Mitt Romney, who famously published an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal just arguing that, or the New York Times rather, that arguing that, you know, it's a sad thing, but we have to let the auto industry basically burn to the ground.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, like
the traditional position of a, you know, of a private equity capitalist, which Mitt Romney was. So, you know.
Yeah, no, I know. And Mitt Romney's whole persona, which, you know, was not just something Obama raised, but which, you know, Newt Gingrich raised. And, yeah, you know, like a very.
Huckabee famously said, you know, he's the kind of guy who comes into your workplace locker room and fires you.
When Bain comes to town, you know, like that's a very powerful attack, which is effective. And does kind of indicate, yeah, there's sort of, you know, the salience of these kind of if you have you know, economic if the Democrats have an advantage on the economic populism, then the sort of, you know, social issues become less salient. And so in some ways, but I also think, you know, like the way, as you mentioned, there's the meanness of this, and also, you know, like things like Dobbs. I don't think people, you know, quite it seems like particularly Dobbs, and I think also the attack on trans people, maybe less saliently because it's less encountered in people's many people's lives. But certainly with Dobbs, you know, you have like a sort of so-called cultural issue that's actually like, you know, impinges on daily life in a very real way, right? Like, and you know, you can kind of see this with how some Republicans are saying, well, we should be talking less about abortion and let's move on from abortion. But like, I gotta tell you, like, you know, like men and women are having sex every day. Like women have periods or failed to have periods, you know, like once a month. And these are like, you know, these issues of like, you know, when you're dealing with people in their, you know, ages of fertility, you know, they just like impinge on like, you know, like medical decisions that people like make as a part of their regular course of their life. And so to have an issue like that, and unless you have like, you know, as you have in some place in the South, a very wide, you know, contingent of evangelicals, you know, who can act as a power base, you know, like where the evangelicals might be a bit weaker, then this really, you know, works against you, I think.
And I think the other thing to note, again, to return to Iowa, which is actually my home state, around during the first Obama administration, Iowa became the first state under Obergefell to legalize gay marriage. There was a real, and there was a lot of, you know, Republicans supported it at that point. There was a lot of enthusiasm about, you know, it would help the Iowan economy by making it a wedding destination for gay couples, but it was also, you know, a sense that this was a kind of, after all the, you know, 2004 effort to demagogue the issue of gay marriage, it suddenly just didn't cut anymore as a culture issue, which is the other thing, speaking of history, to kind of recall about, you know, these things are opportunistically ginned up to stimulate activism in the base and voter turnout in general elections, and then they're discarded.
One sees that really with the, especially with the trans issue, where it's like, it's actually, you know, you can actually like look at the funding and the activism, and it's pretty exactly when marriage equality became a kind of settled issue, not just because of the law, but because of like changes in public attitude, that suddenly, like, you know, like you have these characters who are like looking around for another issue. And actually my favorite example of this is like the big group that really, I forget the exact name, but that goes after trans issues and funds it, used to be a gold bug group. Like their big issue used to be the gold standard.
That didn't work.
Like gold standard's not working. They might actually go back to gold standard, I think.
The gold standard is sort of in the DNA of the modern right. I mean,
I think that the there's a
hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
An element of opportunism there, because in a lot of ways, I mean, you know, like especially with the trans issue, like this actually used to be like less controversial than like marriage equality, and you know, like especially, you know, like things that were completely uncontroversial, like, you know, like drag shows, which were like usually the way in which, you know, straight culture had its, you know, closest interface with like queer culture, you know, and this is the way which, you know, like Republican frat boy jocks could like experiment.
I mean, there are photos of Rudy Giuliani in drag. I mean, if you're of a certain age, you know, Milton Berle would dress in drag every episode of his variety show. This was like, could not be more white bread America.
It seems like a very, a peculiar thing, but in any case, so we're seeing in sort of, you know, Michigan and Wisconsin, it's a sort of you know, very successful statewide efforts, you know, like facing still, I think, the headwinds of some gerrymandering in Wisconsin. As you mentioned, like, you know, Chicago also very interesting, not a statewide race, but like within the city itself, just in terms of a real victory for the left in a period where, after a period in which, you know, the sort of establishment had long had these kind of like, you know, neoliberal mayors.
Right, a long stranglehold on city politics.
Yeah, and it's in some ways, I mean, like, you know, Johnson's win, I mean, like, one has to maybe go back to Harold Washington, like, like a victory of real, like, progressive
politics. And what's even more interesting is, I think, unlike the case with the Washington movement, which was a lot of disparate sort of social movements moving into a coalition, the kind of bedrock of the Jackson victory appears to have been the Chicago Teachers Union, which has been involved in a lot of high profile labor actions and strikes over both the Rahm Emanuel and Lightfoot administrations. So it's kind of like in Chicago, you have this battle-tested union infrastructure that knows what's coming, that knows, you know, there's going to be this powerful, well-funded movement to dislodge them from power, to install an obliging neoliberal business-friendly leader. And they fought back vigorously. I think that's a really important lesson in both of these races. The union politics were, I don't think either of the wins happen without a really engaged and organized grassroots union movement.
Right. And that sort of fits in with the larger story we've been kind of trying to tell, because, you know, like the sort of retreat in the Midwest really happened. You know, like I think 2010 was the kind of, you know, pivotal date. It happened to be an off year, you know, like midterm during a deep recession.
The movement was ascendant.
But again, I think, you know, one shouldn't let Obama and his people off. I mean, I think the thing
was not at all. I mean,
very crucial is that he was willing to organize for his presidential races, but not for like the midterms, and not and especially in 2010, like there was like not a lot of effort.
Significantly,
part, you know, Obama, the sort of coalition that they had built up, but also that created an opportunity for the right. And for especially the sort of Koch brothers with like, you know, Alec and, you know, like, it, so what happened was a real attempt this, you know, systematically turn these bluish states red with a focus on dismantling the power of unions and using gerrymandering to like create these kind of like permanent electoral victories, even if you don't have popular command. And I think for me, what's really optimistic is that, you know, one had both a pushback from this, from the unions and from organizing, and especially like in, you know, Wisconsin, like really, like, you know, like the emergence of a really powerful Democratic Party there. And that it seems to be finding its way to dismantle that operation. Like that is the kind of the story there.
Yeah, I think it's also, you know, important to note in Michigan prior to the Democrats running the table, there was a referendum vote to basically redraw districts with a neutral state commission and undo a lot of the prior gerrymandering. That was absolutely critical to the Michigan victories in 2022. And yeah, I think, you know, going back to 2010, you mentioned that the Democrats were kind of on their heels and not really focused. The Republicans were super focused. They instituted something called Operation Red Map, which was a wall-to-wall bid to take over state legislatures, to redraw districts. A lot of the districts, like famously Mark Meadows's district, was drawn up in the wake of Operation Red Map. It didn't previously exist. it created a monster in this case. And there are lots of other monsters. You know, I've been reporting recently and editing pieces out of Tennessee. And it's exactly the same story. You know, Tennessee has this Republican supermajority that is entirely insulated from any, you know, that's why they did the vote to expel the lawmakers, the Black lawmakers, is they understood they aren't going to suffer any consequences in their home districts. So again, it's a tall order. You have to both, you know, be super organized and disciplined in terms of getting your own forces together, and you have to also, you know, it's absolutely essential to remake the rules, because as the returns in Wisconsin have shown again and again, you can run up Democratic majorities and it just doesn't matter if you have a state that's, you know, so rigidly gerrymandered. So yeah, I think, but, you know, the Republicans have found a way to really aid this process. They have got themselves behind these massively unpopular initiatives, like obviously the Dobbs decision, like the, you know, broader assault on worker rights that's happening across the country, and in, you know, especially in these Midwestern states that were formerly the industrial heartland. So there is opportunity here, but it requires a lot of, you know, focus and discipline that the Democrats did not have in 2010 and certainly did not have in 2016. So,
yeah. And so, well, I mean, I think that one aspect of this is that the sort of resistance has really been coming, you know, from the grassroots. Like you're seeing a lot of sort of, you know, very, there's like national money. Some of these races become national and they draw attention and they get a lot of money, which is also good because they need it. But I mean, like you do actually see a lot of people on the ground organizing. The other thing is, I mean, not to like have a totally optimistic story, like there are places that are like where they're still like either, you know, still keep going red, or, you know, like are going to be like contested for a while, or, you know, like where the Democrats face a steep battle. I mean, I'm thinking of like, you know, Iowa and Ohio.
Yeah.
And Iowa, I mean, to me, okay, the two things that, like, in retrospect, like, seem kind of amazing is one that is Obama won Indiana in 2008, which is just like you know, it's mind-boggling.
Yeah, how did that happen?
Yeah. You know, this is like you know, historically the clanniest place in America. But the other one is like even I think almost equally astonishing is that he won Iowa, like not That's just fun. In 2008 but 2012. And like so Iowa is like, you know, like and yeah, I should tell listeners, yeah, you're from there. So can like what's the matter with Iowa?
Yes. Well, that's a whole separate podcast. But podcast probably. But you know, Iowa was the whole time I was growing up, first of all, Iowa always had sort of the most conservative and the most liberal members of the Senate in the country, really. We had Tom Harkin and Chuck Grassley, before that John Culver and Roger Jepson, who was this awful Reaganite, and it goes way back. So that tells you there's a kind of animated populist tradition that both parties are able to capitalize on. And I think during, you know, the time I was growing up, you know, it's funny, the first district in Iowa, first congressman I remember having was Ed Mezvinsky, who was a crony of the Clintons who eventually wound up in jail on shady financial charges. And his successor was Jim Leach, the moderate Republican who famously would always wear a cardigan and seemed very sensible. And those figures are just gone. And now Iowa, you know, it is interesting. You know, I mentioned the Obergefell thing, and it did break for Obama both in 2008 and 2012. I think there was, you know, as we've been saying, there was a kind of economic populism that Obama effectively appealed to in the wake of the 2008 meltdown. He didn't deliver at a policy level once he gained an office, but in the 2012 cycle, as we've been saying, he had the best possible opponent in Mitt Romney, someone who was out of touch and, you know, uninterested really in the plight of working Americans. So I think, you know, come the 2016 cycle, you know, there is frustration with the record of the Obama administration on these sort of baseline economic populist issues. And there's a weak candidate in Hillary Clinton who, you know, decides not to commit critical resources to the upper Midwest in the heat of the race, but more importantly, didn't really have a clearer coherent message to this sort, you know, since mythologized, but, you know, genuine working class base in the Midwest. And that was, as we've been saying, Trump's moment of opportunity. I don't think Trump could have won against anyone other than Hillary Clinton. We sort of ran that experiment in 2020 and he lost, no matter what he says. And, you know, and it's worth noting that Biden actually has effectively appealed and implemented, you know, what is in many ways an economic populist policy agenda, the most, to my surprise, in many ways.
And I mean, on a broad variety of fronts. I mean, I think since we've mentioned unions, you know, throughout this conversation, you know, like Biden is the most, you know, union friendly administration since Lyndon Johnson, I would probably say.
You know, speaking of that, I'll go in a little into personal autobiography here, but you know, I grew up on a block where I would say at least three quarters of the households had families who worked at one of the major farm implement factories that the Quad Cities where I grew up harbored. And they all had, you know, they could afford a mortgage, they could afford a pension, they could afford to send their kids to college. In the wake of the farm crisis of the 80s, there was massive capital flight. Caterpillar, which was a major employer, just shut down completely. So did International Harvester. John Deere, which is the sort of flagship manufacturer in the area, has a very skeletal presence. It's the only one really left now. So all of that kind of surrounding job security and pensions and college funds evaporated. And Davenport became the first city on the Mississippi River to introduce riverboat gambling. That was their effort to recoup, you know, this massive industrial base. And that brought in all the kind of associated social ills we all know, right? They're rising alcoholism, rising suicide rates, indebtedness. So it is, you know, kind of, it became a petri dish that just was the model kind of Trump constituency. These are downwardly mobile, tend not to be college educated, white working class community that went all in for Trump. And, you know, it's interesting, you know, Iowa is very white. But I knew very few sort of bone deep racists growing up. And I feel like Trump was able to camouflage the racist character of his appeal in this, you know, attack on trade agreements and a pledge to bring back, you know, the manufacturing jobs. But he also, you know, said, in essence, here's an outgroup you can blame for your troubles. And I will sanction that. I will foment anti-immigrant, anti-Black sentiment. And it caught on. And it's very heartbreaking if, like me, you grew up someplace like that and you see the community just transform itself into something that is really dangerous. And again, it's important to note the Democrats, in my view, still don't have a really good answer. They're not mobilizing strongly behind you know, the honorable strides that the Biden administration has made. So it's going to be, you know, even though we have these encouraging results, you know, going two election cycles now, if you include 2022, there's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah, no, a lot of work to be done. And in fact, I'll just, you know, to fully paint the picture of Iowa, because there's just some breaking news from like overnight, you know, like not only is it like they don't have the union jobs that they had now, but, you know, like the Iowa legislature just as, you know, effectively like legalized like more forms of child labor, because, you know, like in a lot of these industries where they do, they still have like meat packing, right. You know, like the companies aren't willing to pay, you know, like living wages, and they're reliant not just on undocumented immigrants, but increasingly because of the way that the immigration system is set up, the children, you know, like, you know, very small
children, it is just
like, you know, of like ages like 10, 11, and 12, like,
yeah, it is unbelievably cruel and disastrous. And again, you know, Iowa now is you know, another really gerrymandered state, and there is a feature in my now hometown paper, The Washington Post, a couple of weeks ago about how Iowa has become the quote Florida of the North, which is to say they're in full DeSantis mode there. So, yeah.
But I mean, this sort of stuff does seem to me to introduce, like, you know, like again, a way of maybe bringing the economic issue to salience. Like, you know, if one did want to, like, say, you know, Republicans are the party of child labor, to say, you know, like, you know, like the you know, like Trump did not bring back those jobs, and more to the point, you know, like the local Trumps.
Yeah, exactly. In addition to which, I, you know, you were speaking of libertarianism earlier. I was actually having drinks with a conservative journalist friend of mine, and I sort of said to him, like, if I were running messaging for Democrats right now, I would say, like, we are the party that trusts you with library books and trusts you with your own body. Like, these are just like basic American freedoms that the other side is coming to take away. We really need to flip the scripts, you know, with all the kind of, you know, BS charges about cancel culture and wokeness and whatever. Like, this is the repression. This is the censorship.
It's taking
our fundamental rights. So, yeah.
I think we've had a good series of some of the hopeful signs, at least, that are happening, as well as Iowa is the sort of dystopian counterexample of where one does not wish the United States to go. Thanks, Chris, for being on. I think this is very enlightening.
Great. Thank you for having me, Jeet. Always a pleasure.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Catch those springtime vibes all over Arizona. Break out of the winter blues by hitting the water at one of our lake and river parks. Take a hike among the wildflowers. Just make sure to stay on the trails and leave the flowers for the bees. Discover Arizona's best kept secret and visit azstateparks.com/amazing to start your springtime adventure.